I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join me on a quest to find awe and wonder in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, spiritual encounters that move us beyond words. In the conversation you're about to hear, I've been put on the other end of the interview experience as the guest. This is an episode of a podcast called Theartology with host Vincent Nell. Quite simply, Vincent Nell focuses on theism and faith wherever it may be found in the movies. So in the following discussion, he asks me about some of my favorite films, from Babette's Feast to Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. Not only that, though, Vincent also took the conversation to the matter of how and why the Constant Wonder podcast came to be. And because that ties in with my own personal experiences of things that are spiritual, you'll be hearing a little bit more about me than you typically would when I'm in the host's chair for Constant Wonder. Take a listen. I thoroughly enjoyed getting to visit with Vincent, and I think you'll enjoy this episode of Theartology.
Hello, and welcome to Theartology, where we put the art back in theology by finding God in the movies. Today, I'm joined by Marcus Smith, host of BYU's Constant Wonder podcast. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, it's a pleasure to meet you.
You too. So for everyone listening today, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself as well as your podcast, how it got started, how long you've been doing it, and what it
sure.
kind of entails?
Yeah, you know, everybody has a checkered past, and mine is fairly rocky in some places. I thought I would be a chemist. I thought I would be a high school teacher. I got a master's in German literature. I went on to editing freelance, starving that way, and ultimately went into music composition.
Oh, wow.
And from there, that kind of led me to be a classical music radio host at a public radio station here at Brigham Young University. And so for several years, I was, you know, doing the classical DJ kind of thing. And then I got into interviewing. And so I had a show for about 15 years called Thinking Aloud. And I interviewed close to 2,000 people in long-form interviews. And so this was politicians or artists or scholars, you name it, opera singers. And I just loved doing that. And I found a really good groove for myself in asking other people questions and never having people ask me anything. And so I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone. But then ultimately one day, my management said, we want a new product from you. What can you come up with? And Constant Wonder, the current podcast that I do and radio show is the result of that.
Great. And can you tell us what is the general idea behind Constant Wonder,
sure.
as well as how long it's been around?
Sure. You know, these radio concepts sometimes are somewhat amorphous to begin with, and they kind of have an evolution as time goes on. But I kind of knew from the beginning that I did not want to deal with anything frivolous. I'm a serious kind of guy. Life matters to me. Things of the spirit matter to me. Things of eternity matter to me. And I wanted to tap into something that would be understandable by somebody who might not have any kind of overt religiosity, but who might then at the same time know that this cosmos in which we live is beyond explanation, is in so many ways ineffable, is terrible and beautiful at the same time, and that this is for real. This life thing is for real. And it also ties into the idea of not wonder just in terms of curiosity, but in the sense of awe before creation, the idea that every aspect of the world that is phenomenal, that is to say concrete and material, the birds, the plants, the rocks, the trees, the stars, everything, the air we breathe, our bodies, everything that is made out of atoms and molecules is beyond comprehension. It has no reason to be that we can see. It doesn't come with an instruction manual. And we have no choice but to be left essentially without words to explain it all. The gambit is to essentially explore the seeking of meaning and value in a phenomenal world, in nature, in human relationships, in history, in literature, in the arts, wherever.
I love it. I love it so much. When I've written about wonder and explored it, one of the enemies of wonder, I think, is familiarity. When you get so used to something, how do you teach yourself to look at it with new eyes? And I have some things I want to read a little later. But I think part of the secret to experiencing wonder is to be present with whatever you are. Do you have a sort of working definition or a guiding post of how you would describe wonder?
I have kind of a, I think it surprises people that my view of wonder is not Pollyannish. It's not about a bed of roses. It's about the shock, the disorientation, the sublime, even the terror of suddenly feeling so subverted that our normal lives have to be put on hold, or we have to in some way, we either have to normalize what is too big for us to comprehend so we can just cope with life, or we're left kind of derailed by it. And to be derailed by something as powerful as the reality of the improbability and implausibility of our existence in this cosmos, you could do that any day. Any day I could walk out and see a sky. I could look down and see an ant. It doesn't have to be a trip to Kilimanjaro or Mount Fuji. I shouldn't mention just volcanoes. It could be the Grand Canyon. It could be the Tetons. It could be, you name it, Machu Picchu. It doesn't have to be all of that epic stuff. It can be just the veins in a leaf. And if you pick that up and hold it long enough and are attentive to it, and spend time with it, yes, this is a luxury. We have our day jobs. But if on a routine basis, we probe these questions of existence at that level, where we have to confess that there is not only, as I think as Heschel might have said, I'll paraphrase him, it's not just that there are phenomena in the world that are impossible, that they should exist on a little tiny planet, a tiny little blue marble. It's the fact that we even can reflect on these things. That itself is awe-filled, that I have a consciousness where I can think with words and ideas and share them with you. It's about our own consciousness as well. See how I go? I go down these rabbit holes. And it just
I love
goes
it
on
though.
Forever.
I love it. I'm all for the rabbit holes. There's so much. There's so many phrases you've hit that I keep wanting to type down because I want to address them. But I wrote a devotional book that I'm going to publish in a few months, and I wrote a chapter on wonder. So I'll just read this to you. There is a unique beauty, a certain wonder in the delicate intricacy of the wings of a butterfly, in the vulnerable yet sublime majesty of the fingerprints of a baby, in the sliver of heaven brought to earth by the hues of a glorious sunrise. Like a fractal design, the great is reflected in the small, and the small holds within itself a reflection of the great. The sacred is found in ordinary experiences, if we approach them with a sense of reverence, says Rudolf Otto in his groundbreaking 1903 book, The Idea of Holy. And in The Idea of the Holy, Rudolf Otto introduces the concept of the numinous, which he describes as a transcendent experience of the divine that is beyond the realm of reason. The numinous is when we encounter something wholly other and beyond human comprehension, which leaves us feeling insignificant, yet deeply connected to a higher power. Every moment we enter holds the opportunity to experience the numinous, the luminous presence of God waiting to pierce through the increasing opacity of our existence.
The Rudolf Otto reference is really important because there's something really dreadful about his approach. This is, again, you know, we live in this time when people think it's a Disneyland ride. Awe and wonder are commodified beyond belief. It's the tourist agent knows to have all the words and pixels ready for the advertisements to get you to go to Bora Bora, right? That's the kind of thing. But to pull us back into the ordinary, the sacred within the ordinary, it really does put the onus on the individual to be a seeker for the sacred, not just to be a passive person waiting for that ambush to come, but to go out with that attentiveness, with a posture of humility and to then really be in the presence of creation in such a way that that somehow opens us to the potential. I would just say for the potential of theism, it's not a given that when somebody feels awe that they're going to believe in God. That's not a given. But I like to think of it as a believer myself, I like to think of it the other way around, that if I am to be a believer, how can I even pretend, how can I presume to believe in God and not be filled with awe? For me, it's a prerequisite. It's like, how does somebody even pray without humility? And the last thing I want to say about this is that there is a paradox in our being important to God and yet feeling like we are nothing in the cosmos.
Yes.
And we have to live with that paradox.
Yes, and that's so much of faith, all these things that don't make sense that you hold together.
And that's where the rubber hits the road. It's not about all these ideas we can talk about, the words and notions that Heschel say come after awe. You know, the experience of awe is precognitive. It's something that happens to us before we've processed it. And then we try to process it forever. And that's almost a doomed proposition. Because
it'll fall short in every way.
It'll fall short. It will always fall short.
I like how you said, you know, if we're a believer, how can you not have wonder? How can you not have a one? Part of that is also, for me, not forgetting that God is sacred. You know, so much we forget the holiness or the sacredness of God, of whom we worship. Of course, he's our friend. Of course, he's our savior. But he's also this holy God. And that can bring you into so much awe and reverence in itself as well.
You know, in the Old Testament, there are the injunctions, the exhortations to seek his face. One of my favorites in the book of Amos, I got to quote it in a recent episode of our podcast, is seek him who maketh the seven stars and Orion. And then there's the Psalm, the famous Psalm 8. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? You know, these are the big questions. From the time I was a little kid, these things have kind of hounded me. And here I am past 60, and they're still with me every day.
Let's talk a little bit about experiencing wonder through art. I'm interested to hear in your perspective, especially from your classical music background. But I know for me, my favorite art form is film. I've just always loved movies. There's something about experiencing story visually with the sound and the visuals and everything put together that moves me. I think it's just a thread that God put in me when he made me. He's like, this is what's going to speak to your soul. And, I try to think about for this podcast, what films particularly evoke wonder in me. And part of it is every film evokes wonder in me. So just the experience of watching them, I'm the kind of film goer that goes early because I want to watch all the previews. I want to walk down that hallway. I want to look at the posters, just seeing the posters of what's coming out, just being in that room and soaking it all in, just that whole experience, even if it's not a great film, but just that whole being transported somewhere, so that always evokes some kind of wonder in me. So for me, it's film, but what is your experience with art and wonder?
Sure.
Yeah.
Some of this goes back to my childhood because I came from a very musical family and had piano lessons early and got into orchestra. And the music, the demands of practice and time were such that by the time I was really passionate about it, by about age 13 or 14, I would spend all my available hours at the piano practicing, because Brahms and Chopin and Bach, these things were so mysterious to me. It got in the way of movie watching. That's the short story. And so when my friends were going to movies, I was practicing piano and loving it. I didn't watch enough movies to be able to be conversant with all of the pop culture references that my friends had. I was practicing the piano. I found a spiritual something in the beauty of harmony and melody and all of the shaping of the nuance of music. It was so important to me. So when I go into a movie these days and there's a soundtrack that's worth listening to, you know, with the underscoring of the music, that's so big for me. That's my musical bias that kind of shapes my experience of film. One of the many biases. We all have a lot.
That makes sense. So let's segue into your favorite films and then we can sort of explore those and what you liked about them. You sent me the list of your four.
Sure.
Which one would you like to talk about first?
Well, before I talk about any of them, I just realized coming into this conversation last night that there is a common denominator, which is every one of these films has to do with the tension between the parochial, the small, the narrow, the myopic view versus the cosmic perspective. There is a greater honesty. There is greater integrity. There is greater potential for spiritual growth if we are not narrow in our thinking or narrow in our experience. So Rabbi Abraham Heschel wrote, "Small is the world most of us pay attention to, and limited is our concern." He was basically saying that we tend to live in a very narrow world. And for him, he even thought that the phenomenal world was too small because he wanted us to be thinking about the potential of an ultimate reality. Some people would say the supernatural or the world beyond the cosmos, you know. And, you know, if I were to look at, say, Babette's Feast, which is on my list, here you have a narrow community of religious practitioners, the pietists in Jutland in Denmark, the two sisters who are trying to carry on the legacy of their father, deceased, who was the pastor, and the parochialism, the provincialism, that's the backdrop for everything that happens to them spiritually by the end of the movie. And that world has to be kind of blown open and made wider than it is. And this happens
with a great bowl of turtle soup.
Caille en sarcophage. I know. Never want to eat that myself.
Yeah, me neither. I was like, well, these are interesting food dishes here, Babette.
Well, you know, when I think of Babette coming into this little community and the fact that they're eating oelebrot or whatever, however you say that, the ale bread, it's a terrible fare for anybody to have to subsist on. And of course, you've got the dank, damp cold of the North Sea air coming into that area too. And there's minimized experience. There's contained existence that doesn't allow them to even think about the possibility that creation is more vast than their own narrow world. And Babette comes in, of course, with just this phenomenal artistry that opens them up to more. It's not about hedonism. It's not about being an epicure. It's not about gourmet food. It's about the spiritual willingness to entertain that there are more blessings than we can even imagine. And the irony that this was a religious community that would be all about singing about God and blessings and angels and redemption and all of the themes of their Christianity, and yet in their hearts, they seem to have closed the door on the idea that God has more to bless them with than they can even imagine.
And I think it might even be the final line. No, it's one of it's near the end of the line, but one of the sisters says to her, no, Babette says, after she's explaining why she did the feast, "Through all the world, there goes one long cry from the heart of the artist. Give me leave to do my utmost." And that's all she wanted to do. And her presenting her gifts to all these others opened their eyes. And that's what art has the ability to do. And then when he's eating the food,
General Lawrence, is that his
Yes. name? Yes. He talks about grace. He's having the spiritual moment while eating the food. And that's the whole parallel of what they're trying to reach with the film. And he says, "The moment comes when our eyes are opened and we see and realize that grace is infinite. We need only await it with confidence and acknowledge it in gratitude. Grace makes no conditions." I really liked those.
A high point for me is once this redemptive thing happens for the community after the meal, and then they find themselves outdoors around, I believe they're around a well.
A well, yeah.
And then the cinematography is such that then you see the night sky. Mm-hmm. And there you have the expansive cosmos that they're part of, not just in the small Danish indigent, practically indigent little village. Mm-hmm. That perspective beneath the starry firmament, that's hugely important to that movie, or at least to my experience of it.
Yeah.
I could tell you then, as long as we mention stars, it's pretty obvious. It's pretty on the nose that Tree of Life has sort of this cosmic context.
And
that spoke to me very quickly. the same dynamic informs this movie, in my estimation, that yes, it's a little tiny town in Texas. Yes, it's provincial in its own way. Yes, the family is struggling with all the issues of, you know, what's their socioeconomic circumstance, and what do the neighbors think, and what are the kids supposed to do in their free time? And then there's the death, of course, of the son. But the fact that Terrence Malick would frame this cosmically, I mean, he just won me over instantaneously with that. I still remember myself just being a little kid, like those kids in the movie, outdoors, running around, free range, in suburban San Diego, going out into the empty fields and just finding what I could find, lizards or snakes or birds or whatever. And I still remember holding up a little clod of dirt and crumbling it in my hands and thinking in terms of, what is this? Now, I didn't even have the language at that age. I was probably 6 or 7. I don't think I'd heard of molecules or atoms, I don't think. But I was just thinking, how can this even be? And that's some of those big, big questions that spoke to me, to say nothing of the masterful cinematography.
Oh, that cinematography is one of the best of all time.
Just amazingly done. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I will confess, of these four movies, I've only seen Tree of Life once. I saw it when it came out in the cinemas. It was probably 10 years ago, maybe more. I went in maybe expecting more, or expecting too much, but I found myself, I just remember feeling very frustrated with the film. And I think he lost me a little bit when he did the whole silent dinosaur sequence with the
A lot of critique, a lot of people dissatisfied with that. Yeah,
and I remember reading how people demanded refunds from the movie, and I didn't dislike the film. I appreciated what he set out to do. You know, I just found myself very frustrated with it, and then Sean Penn shows up for 5 minutes, and then the movie's over. And I wondered what a longer cut would look like. And I loved all the elements he had, the cinematography, the music, the themes and the voiceovers. But I just felt I didn't find it cohesive enough for me. But I haven't yet watched it, you know, 10 years later as I've grown and I've matured. So I might appreciate it a little more. But I just remember that was my experience of it when I watched it.
I think that the dissatisfactions aesthetically with the film itself, they're the kinds of things that I think, why would I want perfection in cinema? Why, you know, what? We're humans. We're chugging out. You know, I compose music and it's hard. And ideally they're going to fit well. I have an uninformed approach to movies is what I have. And as long as there's a little bit of choral music in the background sounding like angels, I'm okay by that.
There is nothing wrong with that perspective. I think that's good.
Thematically, in terms of the death of the son, we know from Malick's own story that there was the suicide of a brother. And so this death is a suicide. And I saw the film not long after I lost my own brother to a suicide. And the personal baggage or experience or trauma or grief that informs watching a movie like that, that's not something I can override for aesthetic criteria.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
In literature, they'll talk about reader response, the idea that everyone in the cinema comes with different, the pre-experience is part of the movie experience. Ultimately, it's inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I stand by my love of Signs, an M. Night Shyamalan movie that people hate. It spoke to me deeply I was 16 at the time. Every time I watch it, I just relate so much to Mel Gibson's character that people might hate it and think it doesn't make sense. I don't care. It just moves me so much, you know? Yeah. We all have movies that just touch our soul, and it doesn't matter how well they're made.
Well, some people would think, I probably want to talk next about Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, because some people would think, how do we go from the sublime to the ridiculous, most people would say, right? But it's not a ridiculous movie.
Oh, it's a beautiful movie. It's so touching.
Yeah. And I think I know why it speaks to me. I think I can say this in short order. It's a treatment of the issue of guilelessness. Marcel is a creature without guile.
Yes.
And most of our movie watching and most of our entertainment and most of our social media experiences and most of our public discourse is snarky.
Yes.
And cynical. And we like the complexity of flawed characters. We like anti-heroes. And here is this tiny little creature that has sophistication on one level. And you know that because of the social commentary that Marcel can give. And he can call out Dean, the videographer, doing he can call out Dean for being inconsistent. And the humor, you can't have humor without having an ironic sense. And so Marcel has an ironic sense. But fundamentally, Marcel has no guile.
Yeah.
Then in terms of the idea of Marcel living in a microcosm and there is a macrocosm.
Oh, it's a total microcosm.
But he is pulled out of that parochial thing. Yeah. And we get to see it happen almost in real time as they go up the mountain. And Marcel, for the first time, gets to see this vista of house after house and neighborhood after neighborhood. And he is floored by it because he had no idea the world was so big. And that's where the seeing the stars and experiencing awe and the cosmic perspective, that's where that movie intersects with that theme for me.
It's such a perhaps underappreciated voice acting that Jenny Slate did with that, because it could so easily go into snarky or whatever, but you would lose so much of the joy of that film. It almost reminded me of Buddy the Elf from Elf, because he's also just another guileless character, and it's very tricky to pull those characters off without it being cheesy or hokey. But it's so important and such a refreshing watch to experience something like that, to remind us to be like that.
Well, you know, with my Christian background, if I think blessed are the pure in heart, that purity of heart, how is anybody going to achieve that? You either have to be completely innocent, you know, you're still 3 years old and you haven't lived in the ugliness of the world.
Yeah.
Or you have to divest yourself of whatever you have taken on in the way of sinfulness, in the way of unkindness, lack of compassion. You have to shake off, or if you can't shake it off, you have to be cleansed. You know, Marcel doesn't need to be baptized. He's pure.
Yeah.
He's already washed. You know, he's pure. I'm making no theological pronouncements here.
Marcel has a soul and he'll be in heaven with us. He's a little shell. heard it here first, folks. And now a river runs through it.
The Presbyterian minister father has a depth that is so beautiful in terms of situating his family, his own life, within geologic time. When he's down at the river and he pulls out, they have stone. I can't remember all the particulars.
Yes, he has the rock and he explains the rock was hewn from, and underneath the rock you'll find the voice of God. Yeah.
That to me, again, it resonates with me because of the honesty of owning our insignificant place in the vastness of time and space. And then just the fact that water is holy. Water is sacred. The fact that there's a river flowing over those stones. It's not static time. You have the fluid passage of time represented by the water. And then you have...
And where they're happiest or find themselves the most is when they're going to the river to fish. That's when his brother is at his highest artistic level. And that's where they, in a sense, cleanse themselves from, you know, they had their first fight and then they went to the river to fish and we never spoke of it again. You know, they keep returning to the river.
We have this idea that there's a division between the sacred and the profane. And I understand that that's part of the normalizing of the world we live in that we humans do. We're going to have to get up in the morning and go to work and get in our vehicles and drive to offices made out of glass and steel and brick and mortar. We're not all going to be fishing on rivers, you know, in Montana. In spite of that, my sense for the holy, for the sacred, in movies like this, I'm reminded that there's something idolatrous about desacralizing most any aspect of our existence in the phenomenal world. The idea that water, I said water is holy, but then so is granite and so is hydrogen and nitrogen in the atmosphere. We tend to make this false dichotomy and we say, well, that's profane. Well, I know we can profane things as a verb. I know we can desacralize. We can be sacrilegious. We can do all of that. But creation is a gift to us, and all of it is a gift.
Yes.
All of it is a gift. And so I'm not a chemist, and I know there are different materials out of which our existence is made. And yet, if it's all gift, a movie like A River Runs Through It pulls me back into that reverential, reflective mode of my insignificance, my dependence on God, my need for God, and the grace or the condescension of God reaching out toward me by giving me the gift of life, a body in this world, the beauties of nature, the beauties of friends and family. I'm a guy who wants to experience what is holy, and I don't want to bracket out stuff, you know, that the secular world will tell me is just normal and regular.
Because you can find him anyway if you truly look. Mm-hmm. I mean, he made everything. His fingerprints are on everything. That's all beautiful, Marcus. Thank you. So I don't know if you have any closing thoughts with that you want to leave us with.
One of my favorite lines of poetry from German, and I'll give you the German and I'll try to translate it. It's a poet by the name of Hugo von Hofmannsthal. He said, "Ganz vergessene Völkermüdigkeiten kann ich nicht abtun von meinen Liedern, noch weghalten von der erschrockenen Seele stummes Niederfallen ferner Sterne," which means the wearinesses of wholly forgotten peoples I cannot dispel from my eyelids, nor can I hold back from my horrified soul the silent demise of distant stars. Mm. Now, I love it when somebody opens us up to the grandeur of creation. And it's not just about time, it's about space too. Opening us up that it's not just this moment, but it's all preceding moments and all future moments. But because I work for this podcast called Constant Wonder, I do have an opportunity to do my very best, whatever that is, to put a bug in people's ear, and you get to do the same. Just putting a bug in their ear to say, don't take it so fast. Step away from the din and be present to what is. And in that attempt, you can be reverent. You can be humble. I think it's vitally important.
Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this.
Me too. It's been great to talk this wonderful theme with you. I'd like to end by reading from a book called Say Yes by Scott Erickson. The subtitle is Discover the Surprising Life Beyond the Death of a Dream. And he wrote it basically for anyone who sort of has lost their dream and needs to hope again and find how to live again. And he has a whole chapter on wonder. He says, "Wonder is the rapturous experience of being alive. It's that moment when all our narratives about what is happening grow delightfully silent, and we're able, even for just a moment, to see reality for the beautiful gift it is. Try to recall the last time you experienced wonder. Was it in nature? Rounding the last bend on your climb to a mountain peak, seeing a view that took your breath away? Or was it the last time you laughed so hard you began to cry? Or when you were caught off guard by beautiful street art found in a dingy alley, or when you tasted something so good it made you emotional? What's the common denominator in all these experiences? What's the connection between stars, food, laughter, surfing, the ocean, concerts? The common denominator is you. Wonder is not an exterior destination to arrive at, like a mountaintop view or a once-in-a-lifetime concert. Those experiences may bring that feeling, but wonder is an internal filter through which we learn to look at life.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Theartology, which you can find on major podcast platforms. We'll be back with our regular Constant Wonder programming next week. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.